In the year 2300, a young woman needing some space from her overbearing family sneaks off to Penn Valley Park in the shadow of the Liberty Memorial. The grass stretches out before her like a blanket, and she cracks open a book. Madeline Landry is a member of the gentry class, the class that now runs everything. And she's so immersed in her reading that at first she doesn't notice the girl trudging past her with a lead-lined bag of charges. Charges are the sources of nuclear power that keep the homes of the gentry running, from their screens on the walls that tell them the news, to heat for their estates, where young debutantes bare their shoulders in ball gowns all year long. The people who handle the charges and suffer the effects of radiation are members of the suppressed rootless class. When the rootless girl falls down, blood dripping from her nose, Madeline is jolted out of her book. Madeline is a rebel. She's always defending the rootless in arguments at home, but she's never been in this position before. The rootless aren't supposed to be in public places. They have their own network of roads that lead directly to the hidden service doors of gentry estates. And in this moment of truth, Madeline can't bring herself to help the girl. She's too afraid to touch her. This is a turning point in the novel Landry Park. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we'll talk to the author whose dystopian vision we just described. Bethany Hagen, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Welcome to you too.
Thanks. Explain the basics of the future United States you've imagined. The gentry, the rootless, the Eastern Empire, and the last war, which we haven't even mentioned yet. What are the socio-political dynamics of the year 2300?
Well, in Landry Park, it takes place about 200 years in the future, and there's been a cataclysmic civil war where the extremely wealthy were pitted against the extremely poor, and it divided the nation. And this division comes right after an invasion from what I call the Eastern Empire, which is sort of a loose federation of Chinese-led nations, and they claim the West Coast, and that creates this sort of refugee crisis of Americans flooding in from the West Coast over the Rocky Mountains, which then triggers this civil war between the very rich and the very poor. And at the end of it, the very rich win, as sometimes they do.
It happens.
And so the entire nation is sort of restructured into something that resembles a much more class-driven society, kind of like Downton Abbey.
Like a formalized class-driven society.
Very formalized. So we have landed estates. We have primogeniture kind of reintroduced to where that land is inherited by the eldest child, regardless of gender. And then everything, this sort of lavish lifestyle, is fueled by the rootless. And the rootless are the descendants of the losers of this war. And they are tasked with handling all the nuclear waste that is used to kind of generate the power for the gentry.
Because there's something that's happened that has caused power, not power in the abstract sense, although there's probably a metaphor going on there, but in the energy kind of sense.
Right. So the nation has moved away from sort of oil-driven power because of this war, because of this war with the Eastern Empire. And because the Eastern Empire controls oil, America has had to move towards different models. And so rather than wind or solar, they moved to nuclear power, which requires, a different kind of infrastructure.
Although there, it seems like different groups. So the gentry, the landed nobility, I guess, they have nuclear power, but other classes of people have other sources of power that are maybe less powerful.
Yeah. So the gentry have the access to sort of unlimited power. So they can have their sort of wild Gatsby-esque parties. And then the lower classes have maybe less prestigious power, solar and wind power, which is less reliable and a little bit more homemade and doesn't require, you don't need servants to sort of help you with your wind turbines or your solar panels.
The Landrys are a Kansas City family at the center of it all. The center of it all going beyond Kansas City, really. And this goes back to an ancestor in the family by the name of Jacob Landry. Tell us about the Landrys and our protagonist, Madeline.
Well, the Landrys are the most influential family in this version of America, and not necessarily just because of money, but really because their ancestor Jacob Landry was the leader of what became the gentry during the last war. He really rallied the fellow kind of rich people to his cause and helped lead them to victory. And afterwards, he oversaw the restructuring of sort of the new world. And so he's sort of the visionary. They would see him as the visionary who helped create their new life. And Madeline is sort of the last scion of this family. She's set to inherit not only this estate, but this responsibility of leading the gentry. And she has a very complicated relationship with her family, because I think she does have a lot of internal pride and love for her father. But she also sees the world differently than the other Landrys have.
So the Rootless live in another part of town. They live near Swope Park, which is sort of like a relic at this point of what it is now. You see a few remaining stone structures, but they're among wind turbines and steel structures, ration stations, places where the Rootless can get what meager supplies are allotted to them. Describe this part of town in 2300.
Well, when you start out from Madeline's house, Landry Park, you're going to be in the best part of town. And in my mind, it was always sort of this Mission Hills kind of Ward Parkway-esque area. And then the further east you head, the more gradually you see a decline in circumstances until you get to the gates of Swope Park. And like you said, it's a ruin, but I also wanted it to have a sort of pastoral feel. The Rootless, despite their poverty, have managed to find some beauty in their life that, you know, they're kind of able to carve out. And I wanted to have that kind of park-like feel to sort of tie into that.
And health is a major issue for the Rootless. Can you explain that? I mean, they don't live long.
They don't live long. And that's intentional. That's an intentional move on the gentry not to provide the Rootless with the kind of protection that you would need if you were handling nuclear waste. And so this creates a system by which no Rootless person individually or as a group, they're not able to get strong enough to revolt. They're not able to rise up against gentry power, and it continues to codify that situation. But what it does mean is that you have sick children and people not living much longer than 30.
And that's the thing that Madeline has just seen for the first time. And the scene we've described, like up close, is this girl falling down in front of her.
Yeah. A young woman bleeding from the nose and covered in sores. And in fact, so apparently sick that Madeline can't even bring herself to touch her because her sickness is so apparent and visceral.
Why did you choose Kansas City as the setting for this dystopian vision?
Well, there are a lot of reasons, but mostly it came out of where I was inspired. And I worked at the Johnson County Museum of History in Shawnee, Kansas, for several years in college. While I was working there, it's such a small exhibit, and the exhibit that had the Edwardian era and the Gilded era, it's right around the corner from sort of the kind of nuclear hysteria and Cold War panic. And after my 700th time walking through this exhibit, dusting the plexiglass, I started to get this vision of a world that looked a lot like the past, but was fueled by futuristic technology. And one thing about Kansas City that I think is kind of interesting is the impact that a man named J.C. Nichols had on our formation. And what he did was very intentionally create communities of privilege. This is sounding very sanitized. I don't mean it to. What he did was he made enclaves for rich white people and really sort of engineered a lot of the things that make Kansas City the way it is today. The parts that are very poor, the parts that are very rich, a lot of that is his legacy. And so in Landry Park, that kind of community structuring is also intentional. It's also intentional that here's the place where the rich people live, here's the place where the poor people live, and that division is cultivated over time.
So is this the future or is it something else?
I would like this never to be the future, but to me, this book came out of an anxiety that this could be the future, that I was born and raised here in Kansas City, and I've been here for 28 years, and it doesn't look vastly different than when I first became aware of this is the bad part of town, which was my part of town growing up. And then this is the nice part of town. And that makes me anxious that I think 28 years is a really long time. I would like to see maybe more fluidity and more, you know, a more dynamic growth. But I haven't. And I think that anxiety is kind of underpins the book.
Tell me more about how you grew up in Kansas City.
I grew up in kind of southeast Kansas City near Bannister Mall, which, you know, rest in peace, Bannister Mall. And my parents moved, they were going to move to Lone Jack. And so I decided I would move in with my father, who lived in Olathe in Johnson County. And I was 14 when I moved. And the culture shock, I joke sometimes that it's like when Katniss goes from District 12 to the Capitol, because it was so different. And I had been in Johns County before, I had visited, but I had never been part of the school system. I had never lived there and kind of had it be my surrounding environment. And it was just so vastly different and so comfortable. And so for a couple of years, I felt like I sort of lived in this in-between space where I remembered what it was like, you know, to go to Bannister Mall and people would be hamstrung in the parking lot, and then go to a place where you go to Barnes & Noble and get coffee, and that's like your biggest problem is what kind of coffee am I going to get today? And but over time, I sort of melded in. My mind kind of adopted the surrounding framework of comfort and ease and wealth. And so when I was in college, I realized that I had sort of become those sheep people that I made fun of initially as a teenager when I moved to Johnson County. I had adopted a lot of those mindsets that, oh, Kansas City is over there and Kansas City is like a day trip. We don't need to go to Kansas City. That was something that I also felt really anxious about, was my own sort of unconscious shift into privilege.
So it sounds like you probably relate on some level to Madeline, not in that there's this whole legacy of wealth and power behind you that you feel some compulsion to honor, even as your own beliefs are taking you elsewhere. But just this idea of it's hard once you have a certain level of comfort and once you benefit from a system and once it's attached to your own family, it's hard to act on beliefs that might undermine all of that.
Absolutely. It's not easy to shift your worldview. And I would always laugh at dystopian novels where, you know, it would take 3 books for the main character to decide which boy she liked, but it would only take her like 50 pages to decide that her government was evil and needed to be overthrown. And to me, I always felt like it should be the opposite, that coming to terms with the fact that you benefit from a system of unearned privilege is not easy. And it takes sort of repeating interactions or exposures or witnessing to really drive it home. And that is something I see so much in myself. And I also see it as a culture at large. I mean, we talk about Syrian refugees, for example, but then once we're done talking about them, how often are we thinking about Syrian refugees at home? It's really easy when we go back to a place of privilege to kind of ignore. I mean, I think it's natural human psychology to sort of ignore suffering that we know is still continuing and still going on, especially when to not ignore it requires either some sort of reimagining of yourself as a person or action that kind of goes against the grain.
Some aspects, and we've kind of touched on this, of the Landry Park vision for the year 2300 in Kansas City do feel futuristic, but mostly it feels almost Victorian, like as though our future is actually this sort of freakish regression into the past. Can you tell me more about that idea?
When I started writing this book, I had this idea of income inequality in mind, this anxiety about my city, but also this anxiety about myself and my own relation to my unearned privilege. And what did I do about that? And how do I cope with that? And this book was a place for me to sort of emotionally rehearse that, you know, that process. But then Occupy Wall Street happened while I was revising this book. And one of the things that it really articulated for me was that income inequality is not a new problem. In fact, it's such an old problem that it harkens back to times like the Middle Ages or even times like the Roman Empire, when the middle class was just a tiny sliver. And most people are deeply poor. And then you have a few very, very rich people. And this idea of a shrinking middle class, of the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer, that it is a regression. And it's something that I feel like I see across our country right now. And so that's why I felt like this would be a really appropriate way to sort of examine that economic consequence.
I hear that your publisher wanted you to move the story to the Deep South, but you really dug in your heels and insisted that it had to be Kansas City. I understand Kansas City as like the inspiring setting for you, and especially coming from here. I mean, this is where you live. This is what you know. But why was it so important to you that for the readers, too, this is Kansas City?
Kansas City to me is a city of boundaries. It's a city of borders. So north and south and east and west, urban and rural. And I really had this idea that Kansas City is one of the most American cities there is. And if any city is going to have a dystopia of this size, it would be Kansas City. And I also had this idea that Kansas City could also be a place where the best things are possible. And I say that as someone who loves the city, but really we're the right size. We have the right we have an intelligent, educated populace. I just really feel like if a dystopia was going to be overthrown, it would be here.
So there's something hopeful in your desire to have it be Kansas City.
Absolutely. I feel that way.
Well, in the scene that kicked off the show where Madeline Landry sees a rootless girl fall down by Liberty Memorial, she ends up following that girl to the rootless part of town. And we can get into why later, maybe. But she ends up being recognized as a Landry, which does not make her popular in that part of town. So she tries to let people know that they can trust her, which results in being called upon to help them and to sort of participate in, like, an overthrow of her own family. So she's basically called upon to choose between her comfort and her beliefs. That's the ultimate conflict, right?
Yes. Yes. And I think that is such a central belief a central tenet of the book, because I think at the end of the day, education is can only get you so far. Realization and epiphanies can only get you so far. They have to be acted upon, and that's the hard part. She has this recognition of what she needs to do, and that's what fuels her.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll get right back to our conversation with the author of the Landry Park series, Bethany Hagen. If you've read the books and you have a question for the author, call us up, 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. Welcome back to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Gina Kaufman, and my guest is Bethany Hagen. She's written a two-novel series depicting a dystopian future set in Kansas City. Hi again, Bethany.
Hello.
Wealthy women in this future don't get to attend universities, or at least heiresses to estates don't get to attend universities because their duty to land ownership, the defining characteristic of power, trumps everything else. So they've got to be married and have progeny and make sure that this estate is in good hands into the future. So fathers marrying off their daughters, wives subjected to all kinds of humiliations as they age. What's that about?
I think in this world, the primary duty anyone has is to the estate. And especially if you're born as the oldest child, you're going to have to carry this estate on into the future. And so the idea is that, you know, younger children, they have the luxury of maybe being able to choose a sort of dignified career in law or medicine if that's what they really want to do. But really,
I guess you could be a doctor.
I guess
or a
you
lawyer.
Could be a doctor. But the goal, the aspiration is to lead this estate into the future. And so everything, the marriage, having children, everything is sort of subservient to the idea of creating sort of a superior gentry class, marrying well, consolidating wealth and land.
There's a love triangle in this book, or it might be a square. I'm not really actually sure what shape it is. It's a complicated shape, but there is a tricky romance situation at the heart of the plot. And I'll be honest, in some ways, it's a little distracting for me from the more serious questions you're asking about class and resources. Why? Because, I mean, I understand that an authentic teenage voice and a teenager in love voice especially is not that sophisticated of a voice. But when the voice is so sophisticated on some of these other issues, when it changes, it's just a little like, wait, what? Why the focus on teen lust?
Well, first of all, I just really like to write about kissing. but also, I really think that even early teen romances in this world, even things that should be totally innocent and raw and sort of without agenda, can't be. So even a really innocent crush is immediately loaded with these expectations. And we see these in like Jane Austen novels as well, or novels like North and South, where even the lightest entanglement is fraught with the idea of marriage and then what that means for the family and what that means for your estate. And so you're not allowed to just choose someone that you would like to date and go see a movie with. You have to, you're potentially making a choice that could define your family's future.
Are you kind of hoping for a movie here? Because I was kind of wondering that. I was like, a movie's got to have the romance.
You know, movies are such a tricky animal for authors because you're essentially giving up your baby to someone else. I will say, though, I'm a very cinematic writer. And so
I would agree with that.
Yeah. When I write, I think I kind of I'm very visual in how I see things in my head as scenes. And so I do think it would be interesting to see it as in the film medium.
What does the character of David Dana, he's our protagonist's love interest, and he also has a similar conflict. He wants to help the rootless. He's part of the gentry, but that standing is kind of threatened. What does he represent for you?
For me, he represents someone who's much further along the path. David is actually a little bit more like me in that he really deeply wants to do the right thing and makes some stumbling steps towards doing the right thing, but often oversteps, often makes mistakes, and really he
kind of lives a double life.
He lives a double life, trying to help the rootless and also trying to maintain his standing within the gentry. And that division is really corrosive to his psyche. I mean, he's a very tortured, guilty person because he can't really bring himself to commit fully to one life or another.
Let's talk to a caller. Al on the Plaza wants to pick back up with something that we said earlier in the show. Hi, Al.
Hey, good morning, guys. This is really interesting. I'm having problems with this discussion a bit because it's so politically correct in some odd way. But what I picked up, what really triggered me was when your guest was talking about unearned privilege. And I think that there's an issue there is how privilege is handled. In previous times, privilege was also incumbent upon it was a give back, giving back, especially in the late 19th century and early 20th century. Privilege today seems to be that we just enjoy our privilege, use it up, and move on. You know, it's kind of like we use up our pious benefits, but all privilege is earned, and that is what doesn't seem to be conveyed in her message. It just seems so politically correct that suddenly those of privilege are in conflict, and there's another issue too, that third generation wealth tends to lose its wealth. So I mean, there are a few things here that really triggered me. And
yeah,
one is
made you
this
uncomfortable.
Nice position of the underdog. There is nothing cute about being an underdog.
Well, maybe we need to clarify some things and also address those concerns. I mean, first of all, we'll talk about privilege and how it is or isn't earned in the world of your novels, which are in the future. And then we'll get to this idea of the underdog and whether the underdog in this world is cute. So first of all, what do you mean when you say that privilege is unearned?
So in Madeline's world, everything is inherited and it's consolidated. And because these classes are so codified, there's no movement between them. So historically, in real life, there is fluidity, and capital, liquid capital especially, can allow you to sort of move up or down according to your circumstances. This does not happen in Landry Park. In Landry Park, the wealth stays with the gentry. The gentry do not marry down, and it's very difficult to marry up, and it's very difficult to have enough money to sort of be able to marry up.
And there's no other way to get into this class in this world.
No, you must be born into it, yes.
So is the idea kind of that maybe the word earned is too much of a, there's too much of a value judgment there of whether someone deserves something. I think that different people are going to have different takes on whether people deserve what they have. But at some point, in history did these families do something that resulted in their acquiring the power that they have, acquiring the wealth that they have?
Well,
because in the book, they don't actually seem to work.
No, they don't. They're entirely a leisure class. And I would say instead of earned or unearned, we could say inherited. This is all inherited privilege. So Madeline, she comes into something that her ancestors have worked for. And so because this novel, this world kicks off with the civil war between the very rich and the very poor, this is the money from the very rich 200 years ago that has been intentionally consolidated and kind of hardened into this class.
Then this idea of there's nothing cute about being the underdog. I do fear that maybe we haven't described the circumstances of this underclass, the rootless, maybe sufficiently.
Yeah. So the rootless, they're laborers, and not only are they laborers, but they're laborers with extremely toxic waste with very little protection. And so whenever Madeline encounters them, they are covered. Their skin is covered with lesions. They're vomiting. Their noses are bleeding. They're often too weak to stand. They die young. And it's very physical. Like, it's a very fleshly way to die and to be sick. And there is nothing glamorous about it.
So, you make energy sources and access to them really crucial to this story. What motivated that decision? I mean, was it, you talked about originally that a real sense of anxiety about things that aren't changing is part of what fueled this imagination, this whole vision. Why energy sources?
I do have kind of an anxiety about it, and part of it is fueled by the fact that, you know, when I was in school in the 90s, there was a big push to talk about recycling and clean energy, and I guess I always had the feeling that was just around the corner, like the future was just around the corner, but really not a whole lot has changed in terms of our consumption, and I think that it's unsustainable. And so if I was going to write a book 200 years in the future, I felt like I needed to address that there would have to be necessarily a shift just out of pure necessity.
We've talked mostly about Landry Park, in the first book in the series. What is the dilemma of the next book, Jubilee Manor?
So the next dilemma is something we've kind of talked about a little bit, but Madeline has made the first step in Landry Park. At the very end of the book, she sort of makes the first step in her decision and how she's going to kind of, it's no spoiler, I think in a dystopian novel that she's going to try to break away from the establishment in some way. And so Jubilee Manor is...
And it takes the whole first book for her to decide that.
It does. And it's a difficult decision and it's wrenching and there's very big consequences to it. And so Jubilee Manor is the fallout. And then also, what do you do after you've made that wrenching decision? And what do you do also when you're an imperfect ally, so to speak? You know, you're an ally that comes from a place where you don't have a whole lot of experience with what the rootless have. So they're suspicious of her naturally. They want to see her kind of put up or shut up. And that that's kind of where she finds herself, is having to finally act in a consistent way.
Is there going to be another book in the series, or will you be moving on from this world and creating possibly a whole new one?
I am moving on from this world, and the book I'm working now actually does still take place in Kansas City and in space.
Kansas City and space.
And, yes, and it's only like 20 years in the future, so, you know, a little bit less futuristic.
Can you give me a hint of how space comes into the Kansas City of the future? Because I might need to get ready for that.
There is a new space race, and so there is an academy in Kansas City, actually in the kind of Columbus Park area, where they train young astronauts to go up and build a space station.
So much of what we've talked about is arguably either... I mean, to the extent that people agree or disagree with it, that might be more universal than just Kansas City. Mm-hmm. What is it that you want people to learn specifically about Kansas City, or to reflect on specifically about Kansas City after reading these books?
I think that I would like people to realize that Kansas City is a complicated, contradictory, layered city. And there's amazing things and there's wonderful things, and they're very... frictive. I mean, they rub up right against each other. And I think that makes it a city of possibilities, of potential.
Bethany Hagen, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.